You're listening to the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast. Hey there, my name is Kevin, and this is episode 5 of the DIY Music Podcast. And before I jump into information about today's show, I just wanted to mention that if you haven't seen the podcast website already, I'd really encourage you to check it out. It's cdbabypodcast.com, and we've been adding new features pretty much every week. I've locked Robert up into a room and told him he can't leave until the website's exactly the way we want it, but basically, he's been working on a resources page, which is turning out to be a really cool thing, and we're hoping that you'll contribute your ideas as well. There's a forum on there, and we want just it to be an open dialogue, because we really are trying to build a community of musicians. We don't just want it to be us talking. We want everyone to be contributing their ideas and just helping educate the indie music community as a whole. So check that out, and if there's some resources you think we should have on there, feel free to email them to us. If it's a website that you think's really cool or just an article that you found that's been helpful, we're trying to compile all that and get it up on that page. And that forum is going to be there for people to share ideas and contribute as well. All right, well, with that being said, let's move on to the topic at hand, and that is copyright and copyright law. We asked entertainment lawyer Jeff Brown, who's here in Portland, Oregon, if he'd come by and hang out with us and just help us make sense of all of this mess. And he was gracious enough to take time out of his day to do so. And I really think you're going to enjoy what he had to say. And it's very informative. And you might be thinking, ugh, copyright law, I don't care about that. But there's things that you really should know about protecting your music. And not only protecting your music, but many artists do cover songs or their version of a public domain song or a song they think's in the public domain. And it's just good to be aware of those things just to make sure you're doing it the correct way and the legal way. So let's jump to that interview. Well, Jeff, thanks for taking time to be on the podcast. Can you start us out by just telling us a little bit about who you are and your background as a lawyer?
Sure. I'm an entertainment lawyer. I do mostly music law based here in Portland, Oregon. My background is someone who's played music for quite a while in bands here in Portland, just casually, and had a law degree from my years of doing politics and government, and just decided to kind of meld my interest in music with my professional training and offer legal services and advice to independent artists.
Where did you go to law school?
I went to law school in Willamette, which is a private college down in Salem, Oregon.
One question I've always had in the back of my mind is, what's the difference between an entertainment lawyer and any other lawyer? Do you pick some sort of focus while you're in law school? Or
typically, the legal profession is one of the last ones that's filled by people who are actually generalists. Basically, what going to law school teaches you is how to think a certain way so you can pass the bar exam and get your ticket to practice law and earn a living. And then once you're out a couple of years, you typically find an area that you like and or that you're good at and devote more time to learning that area and practicing it. And so for me, about 5 years ago, after having been on a law school for about 5 years, I decided to kind of meld my interest in music and the performing arts and film and that kind of thing and go into entertainment law. And it's basically just a process of reading a lot on the internet and books and reading trade magazines, talking to other people that are doing it, and getting out there and doing it. I doing contracts for bands, doing things on Craigslist, putting ads on Craigslist, doing favors for bands that you know. I managed a band here in Portland for 3 years and did everything for them except booking. And so it's just kind of a matter of getting your feet wet and learning more and making more contacts and just doing it. So I've been doing that for, like I said, about 4 or 5 years now.
Cool. Well, for this podcast, I wanted to focus mainly on copyright law. And can you get us going on that topic by just giving us a real broad, just general description of what copyright law is and why we need it.
Sure. Copyright law, that we could go on for hours about that, but I'll be mindful of what you said and try to be succinct. Copyright, a lot of people don't understand this. It's something that's part of the U.S. Constitution. It's not just part of the statutes. It's in the Constitution the same way the right to free speech is, the same way the right to be free from search and seizures without a warrant, all those important things that you see on Law and Order. Copyright's also in the Constitution. The founding fathers of this country felt that strongly about it. And basically, it's a body of law that tries to govern, truly tries to reconcile two tensions. The tension between the right of the person who creates something to control that work and be compensated for it so that they can continue to create other works, and the right of the public to be able to use that work and in some cases change it. And so copyright law is an attempt to kind of balance those two. And basically what copyright law does is it gives the creator of a work a monopoly for a limited amount of time to control that work and make money off it, license it to others. And there are some exceptions to that where people can use that work regardless of that monopoly. And so that's in a nutshell what copyright law is. And that applies to, we're talking about music, obviously, but it applies to film, applies to literary works, visual works, software code, all sorts of any kind of human creative work that can be fixed in a tangible medium of expression is the term that's used in the statutes. So copyright, we're talking about music, but it's much broader than that.
When is the copyright first created? Do I have to register my work in order for it to be officially protected?
That's a common question. I was just helping a client with that issue a week or two ago, and currently under current law, you don't have to register your copyright to have a copyright. The minute you write a song, the minute you either record that song or you write the chords and lyrics down on a napkin, the minute you write a poem and write it down, the minute you create something, a poem, a song, a book, and fix it in a tangible medium of expression by recording it onto a computer or a disc or writing it down, you've got copyright in that work. Having said that, it's important to note that in order to take advantage of some procedural advantages the law gives you to defend or to prevent others from infringing that work once you've written it down, you do need to register it with the U.S. Copyright Office. Because if you create your song or your poem and you write it on your napkin, you have copyright, but you don't register it, and I steal that napkin and I publish your poem and I'm making money off it, and you want to prevent me from doing that because you wrote the poem on that napkin that I stole, it's going to be much harder for you to do that if you haven't gone and registered that poem or that song on the napkin with the United States Copyright Office. Once you've done that, once you've registered it and filled out the form and sent it in, you are entitled to, for most importantly, the presumption that that copyright's valid. So the other person can't say, you have to prove your copyright's valid. The law will presume that it's valid, and that person who you're trying to stop from using your work illegally, allegedly, will have to say that, well, no, they don't really have the copyright in it. The burden will be on them, and that burden entails time, cost, and money that they have to spend, not you. Additionally, once you've registered your work, once you've registered that napkin that the song or the poem is written on, and you can successfully prove that the person who stole that is indeed infringing it, then you are entitled to statutory damages. Normally when you're injured and you have to go to court and sue someone for those injuries, you have to prove, well, I was damaged in this way, I'm therefore entitled to this much money. Well, what statutory damages do is there's a statute on the, a U.S. statute in the law books that says if you're violated copyright, you must pay the person whose copyright you violated X amount. So you don't have to go through the expense, paying someone like me, and the time of proving at trial that this is how much I was damaged. The person who infringed my copyright should pay me this much. There's a big number in most cases, five-digit number in most cases, in the statute that if you can prove that person infringed, they have to pay. And so that's a very significant remedy that you're able to take advantage of if someone infringes your work that you can only do if you've registered your work. And so that's why it's so important to go ahead and fill out the form and send the two CDs and the $45 check, which is the registration fee, to the United States Copyright Office and get your work registered.
At what point do you think it's important for an artist or band to register their songs? A lot of artists are working on a shoestring budget, and scraping together another $45 to register can be tough, or just down the list of priorities.
Sure.
If we're talking about someone who is pursuing music as a career, do they need to worry about it when they start playing shows or when they have music for sale on CD Baby or iTunes? When should they really start thinking about, you know, I need to get these registered?
It's a good question. And of course, everyone's going to need to answer that based on what their own situation is, both where they're at career-wise and what they have in the way of resources. I do want to state that the $45, it really is a bargain. I mean, I've managed a local band before, and I know that there's sometimes we've come home and the cash box has had $20 in it. So I know that $45, if you don't have it, could be, might as well be $45,000. But in the grand scheme of things, it's really something you should try and scrape together the money, if that's what it takes, to make happen, because it really is a bargain. Case in point, I had another client who, band here in town, good band, and they've had some measure of success, and they've been writing a lot of songs, you know, 30, 40 songs, not just the ones that are on the two EPs they've done, and they haven't registered those, but they've been doing some things with a music licensing company down in Los Angeles that goes and pitches their music to various, you know, films and TV shows and product companies and that sort of thing. And there was a lifestyle products company that said, yeah, we want to use this song in one of our podcasts. And, you know, they went back to the band with a pretty lowball offer. I mean, it wasn't even any money at all. It was like, can you let us use your song in a podcast? We'll give all the guys in the band free gear from this lifestyle product company, hoodies, shoes, what have you. You know, and the guys are like, well, that kind of sucks. It's not a lot of money, but it's exposure on this podcast, very popular lifestyle products company. We'll get free hoodies and t-shirts out of it. Sure, fine. You know, not something I probably would have done were I in their shoes, but I'm a lawyer and I don't think like most people, which is probably good or bad depending on where you're coming from. But nonetheless, they did that. And lo and behold, the lifestyle products company didn't uphold their end of the deal. They didn't, you know, they got all their measurements for the hoodies and the shoes, and they never sent them their boxes of hoodies and shoes. And so the band's manager, you know, who I had a relationship, I've done work from before, contacted me and said, look, you know, this wasn't a big deal. It was just about hoodies and shoes, but now they want to take my phone calls and I want to know what our rights are in case we want to institute proceedings to, you know, it's gone beyond about us getting hoodies and shoes. It's about kind of making them be professional and, you know, sticking to their word. Well, it turns out that they hadn't registered the particular song in question. And I went and did some research and learned that under U.S. copyright law, those statutory damages I was talking about a little bit ago, because that's what I really wanted to do. I told the guy, I'm like, let me go do some research. There's statutory damages out there, and I think it's going to be a situation where, you know, if we can prove that they infringed your copyright, which it certainly sounds like they did, we'll be able to go back and say, hey, look, you know, U.S. copyright law says you owe, you know, $35,000 per infringement, so give us our hoodies or pay us even a little bit of money to make up for the unprofessional way in which you behaved. I wasn't able to do that because it turns out that if you've not registered your copyright before the infringement date or within 3 days of the infringement, you can't take advantage of those statutory damages. And so that was a case where now, you know, we're not going to be able to do anything to remedy that situation where the product company, you know, essentially infringed their copyright in that song by using their music and not paying them for it, what they said they were going to pay them for it. So, you know, that's something where they would have gladly have paid the $45 to make that happen. And they're probably going to gladly pay them $45. And they're going to have to pay it a couple times over because they've got a different sets of songs to register them now. But that was something where, you know, it would have behooved them. Certainly, I think if someone's got music out there on iTunes, if they're selling it on shows, I mean, selling it at shows, if your music's out there and it's something, I mean, you can't know what the likelihood that someone's going to infringe it's going to be, nor can you really predict to what extent you'll be damaged, if any, if someone infringes it. I mean, the range of potential infringing uses is, you know, limitless. You've got something like the situation where I just talked about where they're out, you know, some cool clothes and stuff because this company reneged on its word. Or you could have something where someone takes a song that you've, you know, maybe a more established artist or someone with more contacts takes a song you've written, a good song, and they do their own version and release their version of it that becomes hugely successful. And that's an infringement too. And if you've not registered that work, you know, so those are kind of the two extremes of infringing uses. And I think both, you know, I think in my professional opinion, at either extreme, you know, for paying $45 to be able to have full use of the arsenal the law gives you to stop that kind of use and be made whole is well worth it. But it's going to have to be in, you know, each artist's independent judgment.
While we're on the topic of registering, how do you get your songs registered with the Copyright Office? It seems like dealing with the federal government could be a bit of a daunting task. Is it a pretty straightforward process?
It's relatively simple, and I've worked for the government before too, and so I've created forms for the government, and I've also been on the other end where I've had to deal with them, and it can be frustrating. And having said that, the copyright forms are, I wouldn't necessarily call them intuitive, but they are generally pretty easy to complete and to submit. They come with instructions as well. And if you go to the U.S. Copyright Office website, I don't have that off the top of my head. I should have prepared that. But if you just go Google United States Copyright Office, it'll come up and you will see a list of all the forms. So you'll see a section on there that says forms. You click on that and it will list all the forms with instructions. And the instructions, if you read through those, they're generally worded in pretty common sense English, and you can pretty much puzzle through how to fill out the forms. You need to fill out the form, sign it. You include two copies of the work, which, you know, generally is going to be two CDs. If it's a double album, it'd be four CDs, you know, however many CDs you need to file to get two copies, and then $45, and you send that off to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and in about 4 to 6 months later, you'll get a form back that's been stamped and notarized, and you keep that in your file. They're moving toward online registration. They've got a pilot program now that they're going to be testing out through the summer. That's only going to be $35, and then that will go live for everyone, I'm assuming, next year. But it's generally pretty simple.
And are you referring to getting the songs registered? Because I know you can also get the sound recording itself registered.
I'm referring to both, but that's a good point. And not to get too deep into the intricacies of music publishing, which is probably a whole other podcast or series of podcasts. But basically, when you have copyright, you always have, you know, always, but you usually have two copyrights. It's kind of, I guess the best way to think of it is going to be imagine two compact discs on top of each other. They're kind of one and the same, but they're not. One of those circles includes all the rights that are due to the person who composed the song, the person that wrote the music, the person that wrote the lyrics, the person that made the arrangement. That is called a musical composition. Then you've got a second set of rights, the second circle on top of the circle that contains the musical composition. That's the circle that contains what's called the sound recording, and that's each individual recording of the musical composition. So a good example, and I'm going to date myself a little bit here, but a good example is a song All Along the Watchtower, which you may or may not have heard, but it was written by Bob Dylan, which I'm assuming most of you have heard of. But Bob Dylan wrote the song All Along the Watchtower. He wrote the chords, he wrote the lyrics, he wrote the music. He recorded a version of it. So if you were to go look that song up on the U.S. Copyright Office, you would see that there was a musical composition called All Along the Watchtower, written by Bob Dylan. You'd also see a copyright for a sound recording of All Along the Watchtower by Bob Dylan. But you'd also find a sound recording of All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix, who did his version of the composition, written by Bob Dylan. You'd find a version of that by U2, who did their version of the musical composition that Bob Dylan had written. So you've always got two copyrights, one in the musical composition and one in the sound recording. If the people or person who wrote the musical composition are the same person or people who played on the sound recording, you can register all that on one form and only have to pay one $45 fee. If it's different, however, for instance, if you've got a band where one person does all the writing and everybody plays on the recording, then you're going to have to do two separate forms, one for the musical composition and then a second one for the sound recording.
It seems to me that most indie artists bump into copyright issues for the first time after they've recorded a CD, mm-hmm. and on that CD they do a cover song. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, I talked to an artist who had just recorded All Along the Watchtower. But many times, artists will feel frustrated that they're being told that they need to pay royalties for that recording. I've even heard the question, why do I have to pay now? I've been playing this song live for years and no one ever said anything. Can you address that issue?
That's a very good question, and the answer to that allows me to talk a little bit more about the general nature of copyright law in the United States. I talked about how it granted the author of works a limited monopoly. Well, there are a bunch of rights included in that limited monopoly that the creator of a work has. One of those rights is the right to perform the work publicly. Another right is the right to reproduce the work or manufacture the work. And when you're playing a song live, when you're playing All Along the Watchtower live, you are impacting Bob Dylan's right to perform that work publicly. Copyright law says that he has to be compensated for that right. Well, the way that happens is for the performance right is the place, the venue where you're playing that, the bar, the stadium, the coffee shop, the park, wherever, it's incumbent upon them, it's their obligation to go ahead and secure a license that covers the right to publicly perform that work and any other work by the songwriters represented by the entity that they get that license from. And that's what the entities like ASCAP and BMI and CSAC are for. They are entities that administer the performance rights for musical compositions of publishers that are affiliated with them. Bob Dylan is now with CSAC, so hopefully when you were playing All Along the Watchtower in that venue, in that club had a license from CSAC that granted that club the right to perform all the works by any songwriter represented by CSAC. So Bob Dylan got some cut each year of the money collected by CSAC for the public performance rights of his songs. When you're going to record All Along the Watchtower, you're not impacting the public performance right of Bob Dylan in that song, because that song is only really going to be recorded on the CD and then played in the privacy of people's homes or computers off that CD typically. So what you're impacting is that you're impacting Bob Dylan's right to manufacture or reproduce the composition All Along the Watchtower. And so now you need to go and worry about that right and make sure, you know, Bob Dylan's compensated for that right. And you do that by going and getting a license from his publishing company, which I happen to know because I just got a license for a song of his, not that one, but a different one. It's called Special Writer Music. It's in upstate New York, I think, which is where he lives. And so you email or call them and say, hey, I'm going to cover this song by Bob Dylan. And they'll ask you how many copies you're going to make, how long is the song going to be, what song is it, some information like that. And then they'll send you a license. And you pay them some money and send the license back. And then you have to pay them each quarter, 9.1 cents for every copy of that song that you distribute, whether people pay for it or not. If it's over 5 minutes, you have to pay more than 9.1 cents. The royalty rate that you pay is based on how long the song is.
And they can't refuse that right, correct?
Correct. Under U.S. copyright law, and we're the last nation like this. Canada was with us, but they changed last year. This is the last nation that requires, the last nation whose copyright law requires the author of a musical work to allow people to cover it, assuming they've already recorded and distributed it themselves, which, again, with All Along the Watchtower is obviously the case. So they have to grant you that license. They have to let you cover that song.
I know many times indie artists will go that route and contact the publishing company directly, and they'll get mixed signals. They'll hear back from them saying, no, you can't pay us directly. You have to use the Harry Fox Agency. Can you talk a little bit about what the Harry Fox Agency is and what they do and whether or not you're required to use a company like them and what the law truly says about how a publisher has to be compensated?
Right. That can be a very administratively intricate process. It can be a real hassle sometimes. The Harry Fox Agency is an entity. It's a subsidiary of the National Musical Publishers Association, and it is an entity that was formed solely to administer mechanical licenses, which are what we call the licenses you need to make a cover song, to release a cover song. And the Harry Fox Agency is about 60% of the music publishers in the United States, or, like, backtrack, music publishers that represent about 60% of the popular American songbook are members of Harry Fox. So most of the time, you will be able to get a license for a cover song from Harry Fox, roughly 60% of the time. The other 40% of the time, you won't be able to get that license from Harry Fox because either Harry Fox doesn't have a relationship with the publisher that controls the rights to the musical composition in question, or that publisher has said, well, for certain reasons, we're not going to license mechanical licenses through Harry Fox for this song. You're going to need to come directly to the music publisher, which is a little bit harder to deal with because then you need to go find the name of the music publisher and the contact information, the phone or the email, and you need to email them, and you kind of, you know, need to keep pestering them to get in touch with you and respond to your request, because you can imagine, or maybe you can't if you're blissfully unaware, but it's a very busy industry. Everyone's always busy, and typically the people who, especially for the major music publishers, the UMG, EMI, the four major labels, music publishing arms, have, you know, the people that handle those requests, your request for a mechanical license to cover a song, they've got a stack of requests on their deck and on their desk, and the top of that stack might be a request to use a Prince song as the theme song for a major motion picture from Sony, and at the bottom of that stack is your request as an indie band from the Midwest to cover a Prince song. And you can imagine where in the day their priorities get directed in terms of that stack. And I've had this problem. It can be very difficult if you're dealing with one of the four major publishers. to get any response from them as to, can I license this song? Yes, they have to let you license it, but you still need to know where to send the form that the U.S. copyright law requires you to send out. And if you can't send that form, you haven't gotten a license. And so, you know, it can be difficult. Well, I'll send the form there, maybe certified mail. I know someone got it, but I never know that it got to the right place. And I'm never able to find out who I'm supposed to send that 9.1 cents per song to. So who do I send this check to? It can be difficult.
What do you do in that situation? Are you just stuck?
What I've done, I had a couple clients where we ran into that situation. I just couldn't get a response from, I think it was someone at Universal. And I sent them the form, certified mail. I kept the receipt to show that someone there had gotten the form and therefore knew that my client was going to be covering the song. And when I got no response as to where to send the royalties each quarter, I just told the artist, look, you know, I will tell you each quarter what you owe. Set that money aside, and, you know, kind of like a little mini escrow. Set that money aside. Don't touch it. And if, you know, it's ever a problem and they come knocking on your door and say, hey, you owe us money for this cover song that we represent, you can say, well, yep, I've been saving your money. Thanks for finally getting in touch with me. Here it is. That's probably the best thing.
So what we've been talking about just applies to a straight cover song. What happens in the case where an artist says, I took this Beatles song and changed all the lyrics around to be about my hometown or something like that. In that situation, it's different, correct?
Yeah, that's a different situation. I've been helping a client with that situation came up with a client I've represented in the past too. That right to cover that song, they have to let you cover that song. That does not allow you to make more than a minimal change in lyrics to conform the particular style that you're doing. And that actually applies only to the arrangement. So you really can't change the lyrics at all. The situation I had, you can change the arrangement of the song. Let's say you're going to cover a Beatles song. Good example. Another very popular artist with lots of compositions that people want to cover out there. And you're a jazz artist. You can, obviously, your version of Yesterday is going to sound different than a Beatles tribute band version of Yesterday or an indie pop band version of Yesterday. It might be slower. There might be some seventh chords in there. Maybe even change the chord progression around a little bit. You can do that within the realm that you need to in order to make it conform to the standards of jazz, whatever those are, as opposed to the standards of rock or pop rock. But you really can't change the lyrics at all. Now, if it's something that we call in the law de minimis, which as you can probably tell means minimal, if it's only a really small change in the lyrics, the case in point from the client I represented was she was covering a tune, and she's a female, and the song was written and sung by a male. And so it was a song he was singing about girls, you know, it's a rock song after all. And I think the lyric was something like, she said this. Well, it didn't make much sense when my client, who's a female, was singing that, so she changed that pronoun to he, and there was a couple spots in the song where the pronouns were changed from female to male. And so I got in touch with the publisher and I said, hey, we changed the lyrics around because the artist that's doing this is a female. So, you know, it's just a change in some of the pronouns. I know that that's a change in lyrics. Are you going to make us get a license to change the lyrics as well? Because you do need to get a separate license to change those lyrics. And that's not something that they have to give you under U.S. copyright law. And the publisher said, no, that's a pretty minimal change. You're just changing pronouns. So depending on how great the change in lyrics is, you might have to get an additional license for it. And keep in mind, again, they don't need to grant you a license to change the lyrics. Your hypothetical involved, you know, completely changing the lyrics of a Beatles song around to conform to someone's own experience growing up in their hometown. And that's something that you would need to go and get a separate license for, which they may or may not grant you. And I suspect, given the stature of the Beatles' work, they probably wouldn't be very forthcoming in giving you. But, you know, you can always try.
So the best possible advice on that one is just to stay away from doing it.
Right, right.
The other thing that comes up sometimes is the idea of a medley. You know, someone takes a couple songs, maybe even one's an original, and maybe some cover songs, and puts them together in one big arrangement. Is that a totally different situation?
That's a good question. That's a good question, and that's one that I don't have a ready answer for. I would need to go look that up. I know other people have confronted that problem and found a way to handle it. I'm just not one of them, so I would need to go look that up. I would suspect that you certainly need to get a license because it's a cover song, so you're going to need to get that mechanical license. I don't know if incorporating a couple different cover tunes along with an original tune into a medley falls within that right to rearrange something to fit within a certain style that I mentioned earlier or not. I'm sure there's some case law out there on that where someone with a valuable enough song did that and was sued, but I'd need to look it up.
seems like that one could be on a case-by-case basis anyway. Since someone does a medley, the publisher may want to hear what they did to the song to, you know, make sure they didn't alter anything. So in that situation, they should definitely seek some legal advice.
Yes. You know, and a lot of this stuff can be worked out with the publishers. It's just that very often, you know, again, if you're dealing with one of those four major publishers, it's just very difficult to get on their radar and get people to return your calls because of the nature of the industry, because people are so busy. You know, people are overworked now because those four labels have laid a lot of people off, and they're cut down to the bone given the downturn in CD sales in the industry. If you're dealing with a smaller publisher where you can actually get a hold of someone and they actually return your emails, you know, it's a little easier to work that kind of stuff out. And a lot of it's going to depend on the bargaining power of the person whose song you're wanting to cover. If it's a Beatles song, you know, if it's a Bob Dylan song, if it's a, you know, a band like that that's really successful, one of the, you know, probably top 10 bands ever, you know, they're probably going to be less willing to allow people to play around with their music absent some sort of, you know, commitment from the artist to let people do that. If you're covering a Steve Earle song, you know, it's going to be a little easier to get things like that. It just depends what kind of song you're covering.
Lately, copyright issues have been a pretty hot topic in the general press, and with things like file sharing and such. Do bands that have good intentions, who have tried and couldn't get through the publishing company, do they really need to be concerned about some big publishing company sending their lawyers after them?
Right. It's a good question, you know. And one thing as a caveat, to get the license that people are required to give you to cover their songs, you don't have to. It's called obtaining a license, but really all it involves is you. Not them. You sending a form to them saying, hey, here's who I am, here's my name, here's my address, here's my email. I'm going to cover this song. Here's how long my version is. That's all you have to do to obtain the license, is send this form. You know, and like I said before, send it certified mail. At least you can prove someone got it. So that's all they need to do. But so you're asking how likely a publisher is going to come after someone if they haven't licensed it or they haven't done all the right things. It's hard to tell. I mean, I never say never. There's a lot of people out there that are doing cover songs that you know, have not got licenses for them. You know, like I have someone who contacted me. You know, I don't think she's a serious independent musician. I think she's someone that sings. I don't know how well, I haven't heard the songs, but she wanted to cover some songs by Celine Dion and sell them from her website, you know. And maybe she's the greatest singer ever. I don't know. I haven't heard her. I got the impression from my correspondence with her that this was something that just family and friends were going to buy. So, you know, what's the likelihood of Celine Dion even finding out about that person? I mean, it's the internet. You can find anything if you want, but you have to want to find it and go spend the time, you know. So is it likely that Celine Dion or the person who wrote the song Celine Dion sang is ever going to find that person? No. What's the likelihood that if she is found, that she'll ever be hassled, that it'll be worth them to pay their lawyers to go after her? Probably pretty minimal, you know, but there's some there. But then at the same time, keep in mind there are those statutory damages that are five figures. So that's it's a classic. The chance of you ever getting come after or found out are minimal. But if you do, there can be a big penalty for it. And the other thing I would say is, you know, at some level, at what level do you become successful enough to rise to the level of people's radars? Let's say you cover a Madonna song, you sell 10 copies. You're not going to rise to the level of Madonna's radar or her management company's radar or her lawyer's radar. Let's say you sell 10,000 copies of that song. I don't know. Are you on her radar now? At 100,000? At what level do you become successful enough that it becomes worth it for that A, they notice, and B, it becomes worth their while to come after you? You know, I don't know. I guess that's a good problem to have if there are good problems because you've achieved some level of success. But, you know, I wouldn't want people's success to be frittered away spending money on lawyers like me, even though that's what I do for a living. I'd rather have it, you know, being spent on artist development and other stuff. So
I know that the compulsory right covers artists for selling CDs and downloads, but it seems like the issue of music on the internet and streaming, it's a bit of a gray area. How do bands even find out about this stuff? I mean, realistically, we're talking about musicians here. They're not lawyers. They can't pay for lawyers. Maybe once an album cycle, a band will hire a lawyer to check things out for them. But how can they even stay on top of this stuff?
I think a great way, you know, just get on the internet and be curious. And if you want to do shortcut that, there's a couple of websites that I check, you know, to keep up to date on these issues. Digital Music Weblog is a good one, although I think that might have shut down, actually. But probably a better one is the Free Freedom of Music Coalition. If you just go Google Freedom of Music Coalition, that'll come up. And that's a nonprofit group based in Washington, D.C. that monitors a number of these issues, copyright issues, media consolidation issues, health insurance for musicians issues. They're really good about that. And another thing I would say is consult the, go online and find the nearest affiliation of Federated Musicians, Association of Federated Musicians, the union, the Musicians Union. There's one here in Portland. Most major cities have one. Find the nearest, you know, or you can just go to the National Union's website. But I would say find the local one, and that's another great resource to keep up on these issues.
The last copyright issue I wanted you to touch on was the usage of public domain songs. Can you give us a quick overview of what a public domain song is and how you even find out what is in the public domain?
Sure. Remember at the beginning of the podcast when we were talking, when I talked about the overview of copyright, I said that copyright law grants the author of a work a monopoly, a limited monopoly, to exploit that work for a limited amount of time. Well, once that time is over, once that monopoly's ended, and it does end at some point, the work passes into what's called the public domain, and that means anyone can use that work without having to compensate or get permission from the author. Currently, only works written before 1923 are in the public domain. So if you want to cover a song that was written in 1923 or before, you know, you can go ahead. Now, you can't go ahead and sample a recording of that song that was made before 1923. Actually, you can do that too, but that's a separate issue. So it's 1923, and I don't know on the top of my head when that date's going to change. The timelines that are involved for copyright are very, very complicated. There's this huge, awful flow chart that I got at a seminar a couple weeks ago that leads you through it. It's really awful stuff, even for lawyers. And the reason that is kind of a good place to close the podcast, I guess, with the discussion about copyright. Because even though it is something really important that's in the Constitution, even though it really is this grand notion of trying to balance the rights of creators and the rights of people who use creators, it's impacted by what Congress does. And in this country, Congress is impacted by what people who get paid a lot of money there to influence their minds does. And it's been that way since 1909, when the first Copyright Act was passed. And so what happens is copyright law is so complex, and there are so many varied interests that Congress has kind of, ever since 1909, just thrown up its hands, and they've let the representatives of the industry and the other interests that are involved kind of work things out and come up with these really awful, ugly compromises where everybody can save a little bit of their bacon, and they present that to Congress, and it gets enacted in law. And for that reason, there was one in 1909, then there was an act in 1972, 1976. They extended the term of copyright about 5 or 6 years ago. So there's all these different statutes that specify different timelines for when works go into the public domain based on when they were created. And that confusion is a function of the people at the time that that act was passed, representing interests whose works were about to fall into the public domain, set up very confusing rules that were designed to protect just their works. A prime example, and I'll end with this one because I'm probably confusing people, but the most recent Copyright Act, which extended that limited monopoly, that term, from 70 years to 95 years, it's called the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act, because his widow, who took over his seat in Congress, was the person who facilitated getting it passed, was largely inspired by Walt Disney, the Walt Disney Company, because Mickey Mouse, the copyright in Mickey Mouse, was about to go into the public domain, and that's obviously a very valuable copyright for Walt Disney. And so they got the law changed so that the copyright didn't extend for just 70 years past the life of the author, but 95 years. So Mickey Mouse got an extra 25 years of copyright that Walt Disney gets to profit off of. And that's an example of why copyright law is very confusing, and why it's hard to know when other works are going to pass into the public domain.
So is there a place where you can go see some, you know, it's like a database of songs that are in the public domain, or find out some definitive timelines?
Find out when I want to cover the song, can I find out when it was written? Well, that can be very difficult, because you know, if you've got a work that's still got any popularity, you know, 84 years on, it's probably been covered by other people. And so you may be thinking of a version of that song that was recorded after 1923, and it might be an arrangement that was made after 1923. And if you're going to cover that arrangement, you can have a copyright in arrangements too, but you've got to get a license from the person who holds the copyright in that particular arrangement of that song. And there's no right for, you know, they don't have to give you a copyright in the arrangement. It's only for musical composition. So for instance, if you wanted to cover Silent Night That song was obviously written before 1923, but there have been innumerable versions of that song recorded and innumerable arrangements of that song. I'm sure the arrangement that I read sang out of the church hymnal when I was a kid was not the original arrangement. So if you want to cover that arrangement and that church hymnal was made after 1923, you're going to have to find out who owns the copyright in that arrangement and go get the copyright from them, as opposed to finding out what the original arrangement was. And recording that one, because that was before 1923. So it can be difficult, and there's not a single place on the internet where you can go and find out definitively whether or not something's in the public domain and whether or not the arrangement that you want to cover is in the public domain. There are some nonprofit groups that are working to build just that kind of database. And I think if you go Google public domain, there's a couple of websites that come up where people have really put a lot of work and effort into trying to do that, but you know, nothing is for certain. Mm-hmm.
Well, lastly, I just wanted to ask you about actually finding a lawyer. Say an artist or band has something they think a lawyer should look into or a contract they should read over. Where do they go to find one? I mean, how do they know it's a good fit? Do you have any tips on finding a lawyer?
Yeah, it can be difficult. Back to the whole thing about lawyers being generalists, but most of us specializing once we've been out of law school for a while. I would never tell anyone you have to go get a music lawyer, you have to go get an entertainment lawyer, because a lot of people might not have access to one, depending on where they are. You know, you certainly would want someone that's interested in your music, someone that you can work with, someone that's going to be reasonable and flexible in terms of billing and rates, because we're dealing with creative people here. And, you know, if it's someone who doesn't have a background in trademark and copyright, it certainly needs to be someone who's got an interest and a willingness to go and do the research necessary to get up to speed on those issues. And I would say that it definitely needs to be someone who's got an experience in doing basic contract law, which a lot of attorneys have, but some attorneys don't. You know, if you're a government attorney, if you do only criminal law, you might not have any experience in doing contract law. That's going to be a big part of the services that they're going to be providing to you. Because if you're to the point where you need a lawyer, it's probably because there's some interest in your band that's going to require you signing a contract. And you need to know what that contract says and what it might or might not mean for you. So at least find someone who's got a grounding in contract law and is somewhat knowledgeable about copyright or trademark, or at least willing to learn. And I think there are enough people that are out there doing this. If you do an internet search, you can find someone. Certainly, it's nice to find someone where you're at that you can go meet with and be face to face. But, you know, you may want to find someone that's got some more expertise and just deal with talking to them on the phone or corresponding via email. And I'm always available to answer questions as well. And I'll just put in a quick pitch here for myself, and my email address is jeffbrownlegal@gmail.com, jeffbrownlegal@gmail.com.
Well, cool. Thanks so much for taking time out of your day to talk to us, and I know our artists will really appreciate it, so thank you.
You bet.
Well, I just wanted to once again thank Jeff Brown for stopping by and hanging out with us and just talking about copyright. There's a good chance Jeff will be back on some future episodes discussing some other legal issues that you as an indie artist may run up against. Normally, this is the time in the show where we'd have a roundtable discussion where I'd be joined by Robert and Chris and we'd kind of hash out some ideas concerning the topic at hand, but we're going to save that for a special episode on its own. We felt like we've already covered so much information already that you didn't need us blabbing for another 15, 20 minutes clouding the issues. So we just wanted you to soak that in, and we'll be back next time with our thoughts and comments on copyright. In the meantime, if you had anything to email us or comments of your own, feel free to email us at info@cdbabypodcast.com. So to close out this episode, I thought I would just play another track by our featured artist. All the music in this episode has been by Craig Pilo off his Just Play album. You can find that album on cdbaby.com. And I'm just going to leave us with a track called Shades of Blue. So this is Shades of Blue, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Music Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.